Hello, Falava. This is Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Susana Suisuki. Coming up, Fiji's Prime Minister reinstates Education Minister after 3 months. Also,
we commemorate their commitment, their sacrifice every year on Anzac Day.
Niue remembers its heroes. And
they use this income directly to pay essential things like medical fees.
PNG cacao farmers fight to keep their industry afloat. Fiji has been thrown yet another curveball in the world of politics. Newly elected SADALPA leader Asiri Ranjorjo has been reinstated as the Minister for Education after Fiji's leader Siseveni Rampuka sacked him earlier this year. Ranjorjo was dismissed from his ministerial role by the Prime Minister for insubordination and disobedience to his directive. It was only in January that Fiji's Prime Minister delivered a statement on the dismissal of Education Minister Asiri Ranjorjo from Cabinet. But now, 3 months later, he's been reinstated. Rambuka has justified the U-turn, claiming he only gave Ranjorjo a 3-month stand-down, which concluded on the 22nd of this month. However, there's no record of Rambuka saying this. I spoke with Professor of Governance from the University of the South Pacific, Vijay Naidu, about the turn of events. Kia ora, Professor Naidu. What do you make of all of this?
Well, I think they're looking at having some stability in the coalition government as they go forward. So it's survival of the government, actually. And it's good for Fiji, as in it ensures stability.
So you think stability is the main reason why Rambuka brought Ranjorjo back into cabinet?
Yeah, it's stability. It's stability and the need for the coalition government to basically get its house in order.
Well, Rambuka claimed that Ranjorjo was given a 3-month stand-down period after sacking him in January. How is this plausible? Surely Rambuka knows the public aren't easily fooled.
Yeah, well, that's something that's actually flabbergasted people, because that wasn't stated at that time, and it's just come out of the blue. So I think the public really are a bit confused about this 3 months suspension.
Some people have criticised also that Rambuka's decision is from feeling the pressure of leading a coalition government. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think so. And it's not just leading a coalition government, but a government that has a very, very narrow majority. And so, you know, with what happened to Ranjorjo, and as a backbencher, he abstained from voting and all that, then the majority was reduced to, one or two persons, you know. So with that kind of situation, the government was actually in a somewhat jittery position. And if you suspend someone from a ministerial appointment, that's a substantial decrease in the person's status and what he receives as pay. And the person's loyalty could not be assured 100%. And if you look at over the last 2-3 weeks, the management board of SADALPA had given the Prime Minister an ultimatum, to reinstate Ranjorjo as Minister for Education, ask William Ngwoka to step down, or else, So I think that was not a very satisfactory situation. And while Rambuka stood firmly for his decision regarding the suspension of Ranjorjo, clearly there were some backroom negotiations and further discussions. And also on the side of Ranjorjo was that he became the newly elected leader of the SADALPA party. which strengthened his hands and those who supported him.
With Rambuka reinstating Randrojo, what does this do for the overall image and public trust in Fiji's government?
Well, in the short term, I think there'd be people who'd be sort of ridiculing the whole thing. And as we discussed, I think some people would be confused. But there'd be others who want this government to finish its term. And the finishing of the term, I think, overrides all the other points of view. And so in that sense, it's good for the coalition government and good for political stability in the country. We hope that this would lead to longer-term stability in the coalition itself, as I said, which has a very narrow margin and made of three parties whose, you know, numbers just narrowly exceed the number of the Fiji First MPs in Parliament. And so I think people will be watching government's performance. And of course, part of the need for stability is that, you know, many issues remain for the country in terms of addressing social inequality, poverty, and the deficit in infrastructure. And a whole range of social services have been undermined over the years. So the government has to straighten all this out. And so there is a need for stability in the next couple of years.
RNZ Pacific have contacted Sitiveni Rambuka and Asiri Randrojo for comment. Tears are falling in Niue, and descendants of the 150 soldiers who fought alongside the Māori Battalion remember the sacrifices their war heroes made. The head of Niue Broadcasting Corporation says there remains intergenerational scars, as many of the men who were enlisted had never worn shoes, let alone left their tiny island nation. Esther Bavihi told Lydia Lewis that Anzac Day is always personal, with family connections that run deep in Niue's history. She says the Niuean soldiers fought in a war that they had no idea about.
We commemorate their commitment, their sacrifice every year on Anzac Day. And that's when the descendants of those who returned and the families of those who never returned, who passed away en route to New Zealand and those who passed away in Europe, we always remember them. That commemoration ceremony will start at 5 a.m. The guest of honour, of course, is the visiting Speaker of the New Zealand Parliament, Right Honourable Jerry Brownlee, and of course, Premier Dalton Tangilangi. Almost all villages have a monument to remember the men from their villages who were part of the 150 that joined the Māori Battalion from Niue. So this morning, my village, Awasele, we held our service so that we can all join in the national service tomorrow. As a country, we will remember them together tomorrow.
And many children, when growing up, their grandparents tell them the war stories, stories that really impacted them, and like you say, their loved ones died, they were killed. What stories are close to your heart? What stories were you told as a young one and do you pass down to your children now?
I have a very proud history with my both my paternal and maternal great-grandfathers. So my great-grandfather from my father's side, Private Taveli, he was one of the youngest enlisted in the from Niue. I named my son, my eldest son, after him. From my mother's side, Gilbert Godsmark is an Englishman who was living in Niue at the time. He enlisted as well, but joined in the New Zealand. For me personally, I also named my son Godsmark. So that's his name, Taveli Godsmark Pavihi. There are many other families around this island who named their children after those who left. Some even named them, for example, a former lady MP from the village of Toi. Her grandfather's name was Liu Mohito, which means I came back from the war. Another family from the village of Hikutawake who sent four of her sons. Two returned and two did not return. So she changed her name to say that Isiwa, which means she gave away two. It's a very emotional time for us here in Niue as we remember them. They're not forgotten. The histories that our families tell our young ones. I made a speech today at the Avaseli service, and I asked the young people, because we had young girls' brigade and boys' brigade, some as young as 3 or 4. They were at 5 o'clock this morning up early, dressed and marched through the village green, in front of our monument. And I asked of them to please learn whatever they can. Margaret Poynter, bless her, she wrote the history of the story of these 150 men from Niue. That is now a taonga for us and for our people. And it is arguably one of the most valuable history books for Niue and for our future generations as a reference for them to always recall and go back to those stories of those 150 men and to think about the ones, the young ones who never returned and who were never able to get married and to have children and have great-grandchildren. But my great-grandfather was very fortunate. So I'm a descendant and my family is very proud for his sacrifice and also my great-grandfather Godsmark.
And while many didn't make it home, does their blood run deep? Do you see it in the strength of the next generation? Their fight, does it continue?
Absolutely. Absolutely, their fight continues. The fact that we commemorate them every year on Anzac Day, we don't care what the rest of the world, whether they remember them or not. But for us here in Niue, we remember them. And they are the first people to ever leave Niue and take Niue's name out into the world. And for that, we're always grateful. They may have gone to fight a war for a king that they did not know at a time when we had no idea. Well, we know our challenges now as Indigenous people. I wonder what it was. I can only imagine how difficult it must have been for them. The language barriers, the health issues that they had to endure. I mean, almost all of them hadn't worn shoes before. So, you know, those sort of impacts on young men, I can only imagine with much awe and admiration, and we honour them.
That was Esther Pavihi of Niue Broadcasting Corporation speaking with Lydia Lewis. You can also catch Esther in the second season of Untold Pacific History, Episode 1, The Forgotten Soldiers of Niue. Head over to RNZ's YouTube channel to view the series. The Untold Pacific History documentary series is produced by Tiki Lounge Productions for RNZ. Hundred and 75 nations have agreed to develop a legally binding agreement, prompting a major step towards reducing greenhouse gas emissions from plastic production, use and disposal. Held in Ottawa, Canada from April 23rd to 29th, the last major round of negotiations will bring together the Treaties Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee to draft a global legally binding agreement by the end of 2024, according to the UN. Alicia Froon spoke with project scientist at the Benioff Ocean Science Laboratory, Neil Nathan, who's been on the sidelines of the negotiations in Ottawa.
The negotiations are still early on, but we have seen something that kind of happened with the Paris Climate Accords and the negotiations with that treaty, where rather than having core obligations, you know, universal policies and specifics that are being baked into this treaty, there is definitely a lot of movement for folks in different countries wanting to sort of go the route of national action plans or national implementation plans, essentially where a general, perhaps amorphous, perhaps slightly more concrete goal is set for where plastic pollution and waste management is in the future, but completely leaving it up to countries and individual countries to set their own measures, to set their own policies in place, and that, you know, a lot of the definition of sort of what those policies are to be left up to the countries. I would say there's clear reasons why that might be the case. One, people are obviously scared of agreeing to all the same thing in the specific language of the treaty, and it's much easier for everyone to essentially gravitate more towards national action plans. But there's also sort of, you know, equity challenges where you have certain developed countries that have typically and historically had significantly higher consumption rates, significantly higher generation of waste. And then you have developing countries which haven't been as responsible for this part of the problem, and in fact have a disproportionate amount of the burden of the problem, where some of this waste is being shipped there, or the waste is washing, you know, drifting through our seas and washing up on the shores of small island developing states. And so should those countries really be held to the same standards as some of the more developed or more responsible countries? Clearly, issues like that, and this happened with the Paris Climate Accords, is that when we go the route of just national action plans and not setting, ensuring that we have key core obligations, we don't hit these targets. The sort of trying to limit global our warming to a certain number of degrees, and folks agreeing on that limit. The UNFCCC did a recent report and audit of all the national action plans and found that, you know, even if every single country executed their national action plan perfectly, we still would be over our warming limit. That I could see this treaty, in fact, failing if it does indeed go to only national action plans without core obligations.
Right. And so that's the way that it's looking at the moment. You mentioned that a lot of small island nations, and we'd like to know what the data shows and what larger countries are willing to do to step up, because like you said, it's unequal, and the waste contribution is far less in a lot of Pacific Island nations. Plastic is such a huge issue when you think of the likes of Kiribati, Samoa, but there's actually a lot of plastic throughout the islands, and when people come to visit, they're shocked that there's no recycling systems and that there's plastic littered everywhere, and that's also going into the ocean. But then there are also almost plastic islands within the ocean too. That's a huge problem, because that's drifted from larger nations too. And so what can be said for support around plastic and helping smaller nations that don't have the funding? How can we support our Pacific nations who are actually bearing the brunt of climate change as we speak?
That's such a critical question. And I'm personally very driven by a lot of this. And I'm a marine scientist by training. I used to study coral reefs. I've spent time in the South Pacific, spent time in Palau and in Indonesia, and have, while snorkeling and diving in some of the most beautiful reefs ever, plastic bag bumps into your face or wraps around your regulator. It really truly is everywhere. And to know that a lot of this plastic is not being generated within the Pacific, within these countries, and that it's coming from abroad, and also knowing that, you know, there's such limited infrastructure to deal with a problem that is being dumped on their doorstep. That's one of the driving forces behind trying to get, you know, essential core obligations to this treaty. And so what I'd say, distribution of funding and the importance of utilizing this treaty to essentially distribute and channel finance from the global north to the global south, where it is needed most, particularly for waste management infrastructure. That's one of the key things that I know lots of countries are focusing on for the treaty. And there have been some pretty interesting proposals for how to do this and how to close this financing gap. You know, the problem is so large that it requires hundreds of billions of dollars in investment that would fund recycling infrastructure, new recycling plants. It would fund, you know, waste management infrastructure across the entire chain, grow the associations and the capacity of waste pickers. One of the key mechanisms that's being proposed right now and is on the table, and I think also has a lot of support, is something along the lines of an international fee on plastic polymers, or a premium on plastic polymers. This is a mechanism that's been proposed. It's been included in the original potential options for the treaty. And the Mindaroo Foundation actually recently released a report that has modeled plastic pollution as well through, you know, 2050. And has incorporated some of these aspects and what impact it may have. And so when you look at something like an international fee, they've modeled a relatively modest fee. So this would be $60 to $90 per ton of virgin polymer. This is a type of fee that wouldn't be levied on the countries themselves, but rather the producers. So the producers of the polymers, you know, within the petrochemical industry would essentially They paid $60 to $90 per ton of that polymer. That alone could close the entire funding gap and, provide funds that could go into a larger fund distributed to Pacific Island countries, small island developing states, or any developing countries around the world that need assistance dealing with this infrastructure issue. It is not a lot of money. It's a very modest fee placed on the producers. And even in the case the producers fully pass on this additional cost to the consumer, I believe it would increase the price if passed on to the consumer. It's really only a 1% roughly increase in the price of the product itself. So one could argue that an increase like that is not likely to be felt by the consumer, yet could still be so powerful that it actually completely closes the funding gap required in terms of waste infrastructure, recycling infrastructure that could help us get to zero plastic pollution by 2040.
The treaty is expected to be finalized in late 2024 in Busan, Korea. While the price paid for cocoa was soaring due to drastically low yields in West Africa, it's highlighted the fragility of smallholder farmers in the Pacific, particularly in Papua New Guinea. Farmers are earning much more after years of being paid a pittance for their production, but that price lift is likely to be transitory. At the same time, most PNG cacao farmers are old, and enticing the youth to return is a challenge. Don Wiseman has been looking at what can be done to make cacao farming in PNG sustainable.
Cacao or cocoa farming is vitally important for PNG. As a research fellow at the University of Sydney, Tom Swan, who's been working in PNG to develop integrated coffee farming systems, explains.
It's very important. It's around 2 million people, it's their main source of income. So they use this income directly to pay essential things like medical fees and school fees. So it is very much their bread and butter of their personal economies.
For one of those farmers, Agatha Igag, who farms near Madang, the impact of the price surge is huge. She says each year she produces between 30 and 35 bags of cacao, and their value is up nearly 400%.
2 years ago, one bag cost about 450 kina a bag. Now 1,700 per
That's
bag.
Agatha Igag also runs a nursery supplying cacao trees to other farmers. The cacao ambassador, Una Brown, who has had a lot of dealings with Pacific farmers, trying to help them raise quality so they can sell to the usually more valuable boutique market, is warning that a price crash is just around the corner and they need to be ready.
We don't want to see that price crash in 18 months. We want this to stay consistent. And in order for do that, because we're talking about the world stock exchange market, right? So it goes up and down in everything, all shares, everything. So for the Pacific, specifically for the Pacific, what we want to do is, over the next 18 months, work with the farming communities to increase their quality. So even if the world stock exchange market goes down, we will still be able to get that price for the farmers.
Another critical factor is that the farmers are mostly old and getting older, while PNG has a substantial youth bulge in its population. Some of the work that people like Tom Swan have been doing is developing the Family Farm Team program. It aims to foster collaboration in families by ensuring everyone in the family steps up and does their share. One key aspect of this is encouraging youth involvement, as Mr. Swan points out.
What I'm arguing is that there's very real financial opportunities and entrepreneurial opportunities for smallholder farmers, and if the youth were more inclined to get involved in the family smallholder farm, they're very likely to produce money that way.
Mr. Swan says one technique they're trying is the use of technology to attract the young back. He says typically younger people are more inclined to use their mobile phones.
So we're developing a mobile application which would have cocoa farming to help them look at things like how to compost, what sort of amendments they can make to the soil, when the best time to pick the cocoa pods are, pruning of trees and other such things, to try to engage youth in that medium.
And for Una Brown, her hope is that more and more farmers in PNG will come to know what cocoa is and the reasons it's prized in the Western world. She's convinced this greater understanding would boost enthusiasm for growing cacao.
That's Pacific Waves for today. To listen back, head over to rnzi.com/programs. We're also on Spotify, Apple, and iHeartRadio. From myself and the RNZ Pacific team, tō whā soifua.